Welcome to another edition of Heads and Tails. And today I'm delighted to be joined by William Dawson. William started his career as a litigation lawyer at McFarlane's and soon was drawn into the area of employment law, moving to Simmons, where he became a partner and head of their employment practice, and thankfully joining Farrers in 2007, where he led our senior executive practice. Now, William is stepping down from client-facing work and is going to be focusing more on mentoring our young lawyers. William, welcome.
Thank you, David.
So, William, I've got a few questions for you. The first of which is, well, what in your opinion makes a good senior executive lawyer?
So I thought about this, David. I asked one of my sons what he thought about this, and he said, Dad, surely a good lawyer is the one who knows the judge. Putting that to one side, what makes a really good senior executive lawyer, I think, are two particular things. The first is a good understanding of EQ, which is emotion intelligence, for those of us sometimes who express doubt about that. And secondly, judgment. So dealing firstly with emotional intelligence, most of our work in this field is about people issues. And while good legal knowledge is critical for all lawyers, and obviously that's why we get involved as lawyers rather than coaches handling such matters, a lot of solving these issues is about effective handling of the people and what I call the soft issues. So that's really understanding the client at their level, listening to the client, and also listening to what all the other parties are saying, reading the rooms. And a good lawyer will demonstrate good emotional intelligence.
So, William, for those younger lawyers listening in today, can you explain to them how should they demonstrate good EQ?
I would say that good EQ is about thinking outside the box, outside the law, taking a holistic approach to the matter that you're faced with in order to understand the problem in its commercial and wider context, but also in the context of what the people are thinking. What is really going on and why is it going on? And developing that further, the good lawyer will look at the personality and agenda not only of his client, but of all the other stakeholders involved, and quite probably their lawyers too. So, for example, do you have to deal with managing egos? Very often, yes. Is face saving important for your client, or indeed important for the other parties as well? We often read about studies on the characteristics of successful CEOs and chairmen, and we're told that some of them are psychopaths potentially, or certainly control freaks. So not only do we have to think about what we need to help our client reach his or her objective, but what also do the other side need in order to claim a successful outcome, because a good resolution is always a resolution that works for everybody. And by understanding everyone's mindset, you can then start to really unpick the seeds of the solution. I think the most important issue very often in this field, not a legal issue, or can be a legal issue, but in this context, not so much, is reputation and how you manage the reputational issues, both for our client, but also for the other side at the relevant time. What impact is anything that we do going to have on our client's ability to find another job, unless of course he or she is retiring, and indeed impact on everybody? When the client says to you, what would you do in my shoes? You need the ability to help steer them to the right, making the right call when at a critical time for them. Some years ago, I was helping a very senior banker who I'd known for a long time, and he came to see me about his new chairman. And the new chairman was throwing his weight around, changing structures, becoming very much executive rather than non-executive. Well, that's how it appeared. And really undermining what my client had been doing very successfully for a very long time in a way that was, I'm sure, unlawful. and certainly capable of being grounds for an exit. So anyway, my client was looking for advice. He wanted to protest about all this because he felt he was being very badly treated. But he was also concerned that it was a battle that he couldn't win, quite rightly, and wanted advice on constructive dismissal and how to get out. So I gave him the advice about leaving and the grounds for that. But it was also clear that he didn't really want to leave. So we talked about staying and the possibility of just overlooking all this stuff that had been going on and welcoming the chairman, conducting a charm offensive and making it work. And above all, I advised him there was no point in raising issues which would have been moaning to the chairman about this, that, and the other. It was one thing or the other. Either, you know, get the guns out and take an aggressive approach, or have a charm offensive and embrace the new chairman and welcome him. And he took my advice, which was to go the charm offensive route. It worked. He sorted everything out, and his career continued very happily to the end.
Very interesting. So, William, let's say you've got the good judgment, you've got the good EQ. How do you use those to get the best outcome and the best result for the client?
I think that all problems need resolution through some form of process, David. And it's obvious, but a failure to appreciate process can often undermine what should be a successful outcome. A good lawyer will assess the processes that are being presented, informal processes, formal processes. How is this problem going to be resolved? Who has the authority to resolve it? How far can they go? What other stakeholders may want to intervene? Generally, to understand how a resolution is going to be achieved for their client. I'm still amazed by how often clients come to me and say, I've never been through anything like this before. Can you help me? And it's strange because they've obviously put many others through quite tricky processes, but sometimes they've then passed on the resolution of those matters to other directors. And when it finally happens to them at a very senior level, they can be quite isolated and out of control. And when they feel out of control, they need a lawyer who can give them that sense of control back. So understanding the process, being able to say, these are the different kinds of process that we're looking at. I know how these situations play out. I can help you. This is how we can influence it, and I'll get you through this. That's the sort of message that senior people need to hear. I mean, in a simple case, the sort of questions arise around, you know, time. So when is the board going to need to sign off on this deal? And who's going to make the decision? Is there a remuneration committee? Who carry all the clout? Where does the chairman sit? How best can we intervene in that process? At what point, without upsetting egos, to make sure that the right people are bringing influence to bear on the decision maker? Understanding the power plays, the egos, those sorts of issues is very, very important. Now, our objective may be based on the fact that we think this process is not going to achieve a resolution that we want, in which case we may want to upset the process and throw down a challenge and do something different by taking a different, more aggressive line, because the prospect of a good outcome through that particular process is zero. So it's working out where the levers are and how best to do that. One of the key things for me is the importance of momentum, because every process has momentum or a lack of it, but one needs to appreciate where the momentum is building and do we want to put the accelerator, press the accelerator faster, or do we want to put the brakes on, and what impact will that have? And in that context, is time working for us? So is time our friend? In other words, is there no rush for us, and is all the rush on the other side, in which case we have a technical advantage? Or is time our enemy? So we need a quick deal because we are looking to find another, going to go into another job quickly, and we need to resolve things. And if that is sensed by the other side, then clearly we tactically have a disadvantage. Those sort of issues are really important, and the good lawyer will know where the process is going and whether to disturb that process and whether indeed to bring in third parties to that process through a mediation exercise, or ultimately whether, if there's no real chance of resolution, by bringing in the courts or the tribunals, which I describe as war in this context. But that's usually very much a last resort.
We've been talking about good lawyers, William. What are your what have you learned about your fellow lawyers during your career, good and bad?
Thank you, David. It's be careful what I say here. My starting point would be that the employment law fraternity is, in almost all cases, amongst the top lawyers, a great bunch of friendly, intelligent, decent people, many of whom are friends. And it's been a privilege to work with these people, particularly with my colleagues. I think it's hard to beat that as a career, actually. It's been a great, great joy to do that. And I've been very lucky, and particularly so in the last 14 years at Farrers. But as you'd expect, there is a flip side. And lawyers are a particular breed. And one of the things that lawyers are trained to understand and address is detail. And we all know how important it is to be careful. We all make mistakes, hopefully early in our careers, we get them out of the way, we get documents wrong, we check them, we learn to check, we learn to recheck, and to make sure that we cover the detail and that we really have done our risk management properly. So that mastery of detail is a virtue, but it can also be a vice, because lawyers can be perfectionists. And while that can be a good thing, it can also produce people who are control freaks. And that even applies in the senior executive space sometimes. I mean, sometimes, for example, lawyers will spend endless time debating points of detail that really have no interest for either of the clients, just because their ego is driving them and their need to nail down every point. And I have to say, those lawyers are not usually commercial in any sense. And my view is, avoid the detail merchants and nitpickers in our space whenever you can. But the other thing I would say is that detail, or mastering detail, also flies in the face of good emotional intelligence, and very often does not translate well into working with teams or leading teams. And young lawyers often are very insecure when a word of encouragement is what they need, even if they've made a mistake. And mistakes happen, and they need to be called out. But for example, a good lawyer will deal with something at the time, tell the junior what's gone wrong, encourage them for the next opportunity. But when it comes to appraisal, there's an opportunity to reset and to lift a potentially brilliant lawyer to great new heights, equally an opportunity to destroy that lawyer's confidence by nailing them on points of detail. I recall during my own training contract, sitting in a corporate seat, and the lawyer who preceded me, who handed over to me, her self-confidence had been completely undermined by a very brilliant, but very ruthless, corporate lawyer whose skills were very much producing wonderful documents and not managing his trainees. He would have been a hopeless senior executive lawyer, even though he was a brilliant corporate lawyer.
Can you give me a high point and a low point, please?
It's very easy to bring these together in one particular case, which I got involved in early in my career at Farrers, when I was asked to advise a team of around 30 people, or 30 members of a team, of a private client investment business that was leaving the private wealth management arm at UBS and going to a smaller startup, which was then called Vestra. And I can talk about this because it was reported in the law reports as one of the leading cases on springboard relief. Now, we came on the scene when lawyers advising Vestra had already advised on the mass resignations of the all the individuals in question, and the guns at UBS had been spiked. They were very upset about the way this had played out, and they wanted to make something out of this situation. So I inherited a large team of mainly senior, but also some junior people who were collectively holding their breath, working out their notice. There was a sense that they were being watched, and no one knew what was going on, rather like 1940, I suspect. As we developed into the summer, you know, the sense of phony war only got greater and greater. And then UBS struck, and the beginning of the long vacation, which was a masterly stroke by Herbert Smith, their lawyers, we were hauled before the courts, and an interim injunction was obtained on some fairly flimsy evidence, but brilliant advocacy. And at the end of that day, lawyers for Vestra and myself as the lawyer for the team retreated to Farrah's, and I produced some Farrah's Chablis, and we sat down. Some of the heads were very low, but we knew that we'd lost the battle. We very quickly worked out that we hadn't lost the war. And indeed, you know, working out the strategy from there was enormously interesting. And a few months later, we got the matter resolved on favorable terms. And the high point for me was on the 1st of January the following year, or rather probably about the 2nd of January, actually, but the first day of open business the following year, walking into the dealing room with all my clients, smiles, you know, huge positive feeling, wonderful energy. They were all raring to go. And I just remember thinking, it was a tough journey, but by gum, it was worth it. It's a great moment. It's what our careers are really all about.
I love it, William. So, William, thank you. What's the most important lesson that you've learned in your career?
That's an easy one, David. We work in a profession which is all about service, and those who we service are our clients. And while relationships with our colleagues are essential, and the importance of good relationships with our clients are really, really key. And how we manage those relationships is the answer. And the key point on that is that we need to take control of our relationships with our clients and not let our clients control us. I remember being told as a trainee, as my life was being dominated by various clients and by the partners at the time, the client is always right. Well, that's true, but only to a point. Yeah, an example of that is a few years back, a senior banker, and in fact, one of the brightest people I've ever had the pleasure to work with, came to see me to ask me to pitch for advising him on what was likely to be a long process involving massive investigations at his bank. He had been in a very senior position, and he was still in that position, but a bad result for him could jeopardize his career completely. And we sat down, I remember in conference room 10, he said to me and my colleague, I have a day job between 8:30 a.m. and 5:30 in the afternoon. I need you to commit to working with me outside those working hours for the duration of the project. Can you do that? So I looked at my colleague and she looked back at me whimsically. And I turned back to him, I said, I'm sorry, Mr. X, we don't work for clients on that basis. I can assure you that many clients will testify to our reliability, support, diligence, and we will look after you. No questions on that front, but we can't work for you on the basis that you suggest. He then said, oh, and the interview progressed and finished, and it was fine. And the following day he rang, and he rang to appoint us. And when I was a little surprised, actually, after that start, and he said, well, the answer to that question had been decisive, because it showed that we were not prepared to fall over when we were pushed. So showing a bit of strength with the client had paid dividends.
Slightly reminds me of some of the things I say to myself in training my puppy. Always let her know he's in control.
Yeah.
So, William, completely different. What would you choose as your favourite work of art?
Quite clear choice on this would be a painting which sits above the altar piece in the Frari in Venice, and that is Titian's Assumption. I went to a course in Venice before going up to university, and I had done some studying in advance and was particularly looking forward to seeing this magnificent painting. And we were then told about it in lectures in Venice, but also told that it was undergoing restoration and had been withdrawn. So it was very disappointing to go to the Frari and see the altar shrouded with various cloths, and the painting was unavailable. But I resolved to go back, and I did that 3 years later. And I've since been back on many occasions, as I think those of us who form a love affair with Venice are bound to do. And I've admired this glorious painting of the Assumption of Mary sitting on a cloud above pale blue sky, her shrouded dress in deep reds and deep blues rising up into the heavens, and your eyes compelled upwards to this burnished gold background as she is going up. It is really quite a remarkable experience to see the painting, and I will always go back and see that when I get the chance.
William, you've clearly had a lot of fun and enjoyment in your career, and you have, it seems to me, approached retirement with a similar gusto to that with which you've approached your career. There are a lot of senior lawyers likely to be listening to this who haven't yet retired, but may be approaching it in the next, 5 or 10 years. How have you approached retirement, and how would you advise them to approach retirement?
Well, I think part of control we were talking about earlier on is about having the time always to reflect. And I have applied that thought to the retirement process at regular intervals. It's very easy late in your career to go through a bad moment when a client has been particularly difficult and just say, that's enough.
Mm.
But you should never make a decision based on that sort of knee-jerk moment. And for me, planning retirement has been a process over 3, 4, maybe even 5 years, which has been evolutionary. It hasn't gone the way that I expected, but it's been gradual change of focus, letting certain things go, taking other things up. And for me, it's been a part of a life-enhancing career, and it's only continuing to be so. My advice to other lawyers is that they need to take time over this decision. And I think law firms very often fail their senior lawyers at this point because they don't allow enough time and support. And indeed, they waste some of their most important assets, people with great wisdom, by losing them in a bump. And a bump, a sudden change, can be bad for everybody. So for me, gradual change, a lot of debate, a lot of support is the way forward. And I'm most grateful to all my colleagues at Farrer's, and this isn't a punt, it's just simply saying genuinely, thank you for making the process so seamless and indeed ongoing.
William, it's been a joy to chat to you today and hear about your career highs and lows and your tips for junior lawyers. I'm pleased that you're not going to be leaving in a bump, because you're still going to be involved in the Farrer's team, helping some of our more junior lawyers and imparting some of the wisdom and actually the fun that you've had in your career, because I think fun is essential too. William, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.